Aloha, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Welcome to The Body Show. Each week we talk about health and fitness, but none of what we discuss replaces a visit to your own primary care provider. Lasers. We might be familiar with these being used for different types of surgeries, eye procedures, skin procedures, but recently the FDA has approved the use of lasers for a whole lot more than that. Plantar fasciitis, chronic neck pain, acne, even cosmetic surgery are all now approved uses for laser treatments. How does it work and why? Well, we'll find out a little later in the show. But first, we have a few more of the summer student research students here from Hawaii Pacific Health in the studio. We have a few more new projects to learn about that are happening right here in Hawaii that might just change the course of medicine in the near future. Research is where it all starts, and in order to determine if something is an effective treatment or a common symptom of a particular illness, you know, it all starts with establishing a hypothesis and doing research to find out the answer to that scientific question. Now, today we have three fantastic students here to share their summer projects. First, we have Amanda Suhaku. She is a student at USF studying biology and Japanese studies. And you're working with one of my colleagues, Dr. Maldini, looking at appendicitis. Amanda, welcome to The Body Show.
Hi, nice. Great to be here.
Well, tell me, you know, we know if your appendix is inflamed, you got to get it out. So what sort of particular area are you researching about appendicitis?
Well, Dr. Maldini strongly believes that if you get diagnosed with appendicitis, that you should get it out immediately, right away, because that minimizes the pain you're in and stuff. But other research around the United States has shown that it's okay to, like, wait a day or two, like, just with antibiotics. And that way, like, the surgeon can be fully awake, if not in the middle of the night. And then, like, it's mainly to the doctor's preference.
So instead of rushing in at 2 a.m., quick, go in and do this appendicitis. Some research has suggested that you could actually wait and schedule it the next day.
Exactly.
Now, Dr. Maldini once says, you know, hey, get it out, you get it diagnosed. And so what are you discovering in the research? Does it make a difference?
We're actually seeing that it doesn't show differences, but we're only looking at infection outcomes, like postoperatively. But maybe if we looked at patient like pain tolerance and stuff, we would see that they would want it out right away.
Well, on the other hand, sometimes I think as a patient, if I come in at like 3 a.m. with some kind of weird thing and have to go to emergency surgery, I don't know, I kind of want my surgeon to have a lot of sleep.
Very true.
You know, so I guess it goes both ways. On the other hand, the clinical outcome of infection sounds like it's pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're finding with your research is that what they've studied elsewhere is really true so far from that particular area infection.
Yes.
And so appendicitis, important, get it out at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have to be like yesterday.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Now, you're going back to USF, and when are you finished school?
I'm going to be graduating in May 2015, so I'm going to be a senior this year.
Fantastic. Best year, senior in college. And after that, what are you going to do?
I'm hoping to apply through the JET program, which is an English teaching in Japan, and hopefully do that for a year and then apply to medical school.
Great. Good way to get some life experience, kind of have your own gap year.
Exactly.
You know, we don't do that so much here in the U.S., but I think it's an invaluable time. And hey, if you can get your parents to pay for you to go to Japan and get some experience, definitely do that.
Thanks for saying that to my dad who's listening.
Yeah, and I was not planted to do that, Dad, I swear. All right, well, thanks for telling us about your project coming up. Next, we have Teresa Porter. Teresa, you're talking and researching about something very near and dear to my heart. Now, you're at UH Manoa studying biology and English, but you're working on improving hospice education for people at a particular location, Hawaii Pacific Health. You're working with Dr. Dawn Mina'ai. What exactly are you trying to improve, and how has it worked?
We're actually doing a quality improvement study. So we're looking at how patients are educated, what stage, and then also like the workflow. How are we including the hospice, the clinic itself, and then the hospices, and getting that communication to flow, since there's a lot of miscommunication, a lot of communication that isn't available to most doctors, even after they've referred the patient into hospice.
So what you're finding is that if you're able to improve that workflow, kind of standardize that way that people either get referred to hospice or information gets sent back to their doctors, get everybody on the team involved, that it's working better?
Definitely. We actually have just started collecting data from hospices, starting to look at how much the increase is with the length of stay. And we're still seeing that the length of stay is rather short, and it can actually be started earlier. A lot of the times, the clinic, the outpatient clinic, is where you want to have people learn about these things, not about after they've had some kind of find out they have some kind of major terminal cancer. And that's not the point. They want to learn about this stuff. It's as they progress, they want to learn about end-of-life care.
So should we be, as physicians, should we be educating people about what their options might be in the future, even when we don't see a foreseeable illness?
I would say yes, but conditionally. There's really important times when people have dementia or they can't take care of themselves at home, and they really need extra resources in order to make their lives more improved and have like a better life living style, actually.
Absolutely. You know, the state just put out a paper about a week or so ago where they were looking at trying to be part of a nationwide Healthy People initiative, that by 2025, we should really be working a lot harder on dementia, establishing dementia clinics, establishing memory clinics, really trying to coordinate all those services specifically for the diagnosis of dementia. But it sounds like we also need to take a look at end-of-life care as well.
Definitely.
An important thing for us to consider. Now, as you've worked on this with Dr. Minnai, you now know about some of the services available in hospice. Would you ever talk to your grandparents about it?
It's actually really difficult to have these conversations with loved ones. Most of the time we were taught, like, you should start with, like, a question. Just start feeling the ground. There's different paperwork out there that they can look at, like the Pulse or advanced directives. But those paperworks, maybe you want to wait until you kind of get the groundwork settled. And just having a basic knowledge of what your family or what your grandparents want for end-of-life care, it can actually really shock you. I didn't know several things about my family until I asked questions, because it was just my own instinct, like what I would want for them.
And I think that's the important point, which is it's not so much what you or I would want, but it's really what they would want. And having that discussion before they have dementia, before they have some other sort of terminal illness, might actually be a good way to get to know what they want in the future. And it can only, you know, granted, it's not the most uplifting, you know, Thanksgiving conversation. Hey, Grandma, when you're about to die, what would you like? On the other hand, it's an important discussion to start somewhere, because you never want to be, I mean, certainly as a physician, I never want to be in the position where I have family members who really don't understand what their loved one wants, and they all disagree. And maybe they all have different opinions. And if only we knew what that one person wanted. So you're right. It certainly sounds like that's a very important project, working on improving not just hospice education, but really all end-of-life care, letting people know what's out there. So, all right. And then after what you're going back to UH now, mm-hmm. After that, what are your plans?
After UH, I'll graduate in May 2015.
Gap year.
I got accepted into Teach for America.
So wonderful.
I'm
okay.
I'll be going to Colorado, Denver, and teaching for 2 years.
So. Fabulous. So you're going from here to Denver.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You're going to be cold.
I will be cold.
Bring some warm clothes. You'll actually probably have to buy some warm clothes in Denver. I don't know how easy it is to find warm clothes here, but that sounds really exciting. So you'll be able to use what you've learned in education to teach other people as well.
Yes.
Fantastic. All right. Great to hear about it. And last but not least, we have Tanner Hoke. You're working on ACL outcomes. That's the anterior cruciate ligament. Where is that in the body? And you're working with my buddy, Dr. Spencer Chang. What is it that we're learning about it?
So the anterior cruciate ligament, or ACL, is in your knee, and it's a pretty common knee injury, especially in athletes. And specifically, we're looking at autograft or allograft reconstruction outcomes.
So autograft, allograft, you mean taking a piece of your own mm-hmm. tissue versus
yes.
taking a piece
yes.
of tissue coming from where?
So autograft tissues are usually taken from a patient's own body, typically from the hamstring muscle or patellar tendon. Our allograft tissues are taken from cadavers, and we use posterior tibialis tendon allografts.
So what are you finding so far?
So right now we're finding that there are no graft failures as of right now. Dr. Chang is doing a really great job. However, we have a really short follow-up duration of about 1 year, but it generally takes about 2 years of a minimum follow-up duration to adequately assess an ACL reconstruction.
So do you think we need to start following people for a lot longer?
Yes. So we're finding that once patients don't really have any more complaints or pain or any other complications, or once they're cleared to return to their full activity or return to sport, they kind of stop coming in to see Dr. Chang. So we're hoping to get more follow-up data from them, call them back into the office and see how they're doing in order to more accurately evaluate the outcomes of his reconstructions.
Sure. And you're looking at trying to distinguish between whether or not the graft from your own tissue versus the graft from a cadaver tissue,
yes.
not so alive person's tissue, if there's any difference in how they do long term.
That is correct.
Okay. Yep. And that sounds like another important piece of information because, you know, some people definitely want to do one versus the other. This might help them to realize which one would be better long term.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you're at Claremont McKenna College in California. You're studying biology, and I know you're a sophomore now.
Yes, going to be a junior.
Going to be a junior. And what's your plan after school?
After school, I'll be applying to medical school, kind of like these two ladies next to me, maybe taking a gap year. I don't know what the future holds, but we'll see. Yeah.
Well, you know, if I can advocate for the gap year, you know, it's funny because when I went through schooling, I kind of did it a little bit more in an accelerated path. And looking back, I don't know if I would change that, but I certainly think that there's a time in your life when you're young, when you don't have a lot of other responsibilities, when you could go travel the world, don't mind kind of, you know, living in a youth hostel and doing that sort of stuff. Go now while you can.
Yeah.
Convince your parents, sorry parents, to pay for it because that would be fabulous. But never be afraid of school loans. I'm a big advocate of that because I took a whole bunch of loans, never regretted it for an instant. Definitely helped me go out and do a lot of traveling that I otherwise wouldn't be able to do. So thanks to all of you for joining us today and for your hard work on your projects. You have a big presentation coming up in a couple of nights, and I'm sure you're going to do fantastic. So thanks for joining us. All right, now we're talking today about lasers. How are they used in medicine and why? And if you or a loved one has ever had a laser treatment done, did it work? You can join us. We're going to be talking with Leslie Iskovitz, and we're going to be right here at 941-3689 on Oahu, toll-free Neighbor Islands, 877-941-3689. Leslie, welcome to The Body Show.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Kozak.
Well, I'm happy to have you here. Now, I'm curious because you sort of have an alternative pathway to getting involved and interested in lasers. Tell me a little bit about how this became a passion of yours.
Well, what happened was, besides being a lawyer, I've also been an entrepreneur, and I've done different businesses over the 35 years I've been here. And I owned a restaurant called Volcano Joe's, used to be across the street from the University of Hawaii. And so one day I was picking up a piece of glass that I didn't know that one of my employees had broke. And it cut a flap of skin on my hand, on my finger, that blood gushing needed stitches. And I said, it's Sunday. I don't feel like going to an ER and spending hours there. So I stopped the bleeding with a couple of Band-Aids. And next day I was visiting my friend who owned a massage school in Kailua. And she said, oh, I got this new laser supposed to help wounds. So I took off the Band-Aids and I said, well, better help through the Band-Aids because it was still bleeding. It was still fresh. So I did a quick five-minute laser treatment, put new bandages on it. And next day, it was more than 50% healed, no longer needed stitches. So I said, this is pretty amazing. So I'm no fool. I went back over the hill, did another treatment, and it was again 50% healed. And that started a process of how is it that a light that you can't feel can actually accelerate healing and get rid of pain? So I would start to use her laser whenever there was an opportunity. So she would have a bunch of tables at the marathon. So she invited me in, gave me a person who spoke Japanese because it was in the jail pack tent. And I treated 15 marathon runners, all limped in with pain level 10 in their knees and or ankles. And I gave them each a five-minute treatment. And within 5 minutes, their pain dropped anywhere from 30 to 100%. They were just amazed. They were Japanese. I couldn't really communicate well with them. And I had no ability to follow up. And that just started a process. Whenever I had an opportunity, someone came in, like my mother, who's now 96. She came in about 10 years ago with a horrible case of cellulitis. And my brother's an internist, a rheumatologist, allergist in California, lives close to her in California. And he was leaving for weeks, and I brought her over here to stay with me because she couldn't be alone. And she was at pain level 10. And I treated her with a laser, and the cellulitis cleared up. The pain went away, the cycle of pain level 10 disappeared, like very, very quickly. And over the course of the next few weeks, she got better and took her back and all the blood tests. So I just took that as a sign that one of the things I'm supposed to do is help bring awareness of this amazing technology to more people, you know, both potential patients as well as the medical establishment.
Now, when you started this whole process, granted it was from an injury yourself, and good that the something helped you, because if you have a cut and it's more than 24 hours old, it's too late for stitches. I mean, we don't want to stitch in bacteria. So had you gone back to get your stitches a day or so later, I'll be honest, you wouldn't have gotten them, unfortunately. But now, in addition to when you mentioned doing laser treatments, you've actually gone to some seminars and learned how to use the laser. I mean, I don't want to give off the impression that you just went around and said, okay, I'm going to try this on everybody. I mean, you did go through a training process to understand how to use the laser.
Oh, yeah. I've gone through 7 full weekend seminars from 5 different teachers learning about how to treat different conditions with the laser.
Now, the FDA has actually looked at lasers. And, you know, when I was in medical school and through training, we weren't generally using lasers other than maybe laser eye surgery. It wasn't part of the standard practice of medicine. And now the FDA has actually cleared laser treatments for a variety of different applications. And sometimes you can actually see some ads, try laser treatments for arthritis, for different types of joint issues, plantar fasciitis, this really painful heel condition. What are some of the areas that you know of that are currently the targets for lasers that are FDA approved?
Well, the first clearance, Erconia was the first company to get an FDA clearance for a low-level laser. And what they did was they submitted it for chronic neck and shoulder pain. And after they did the tests, they submitted it to the FDA. They said, you know, we don't trust that. They made them do a whole second round of tests. So same results, 80% had pain relief. Placebo had 15%, so there's a big difference between the two. And so chronic neck and shoulder pain was the first one released, cleared in 2002. They had to come up with a new designation because before that, everything with light was ILY, which meant it was heat, infrared heat. And this became NHN, a non-heating. So then in 2004, they got a laser cleared for pre-liposuction fat emulsification and post-lipo pain. 2005, the laser was cleared for treating moderate acne. 2008, the laser was cleared for treating post-breast augmentation pain. 2010, the laser was cleared for non-invasive fat reduction of 3 to 6 inches combined off waist hips and thighs. And then this year, they have one that was cleared for cellulite. It takes a full stage of cellulite appearance and fat reduction. And also, they had it cleared this year for treating heel pain caused by chronic plantar fasciitis.
Now, I want to mention when we talk about the FDA clearing it, they're actually looking at clinical trials to see if it's an applicable treatment and looking at, they're looking at blinded trials. I mean, placebo versus laser. There's this term we use in medicine called the randomized double-blinded clinical trial as sort of a gold standard of evidence. And some of the studies that they've done with the lasers are actually using that.
All 8 of the clearances I just mentioned, each one was obtained pursuant to IRB-approved randomized double-blind clinical studies with placebo control.
That's like that like little gold star in
right.
medicine, because an IRB being the institutional review board, but that's the way that we know our studies actually really being done to show an effect. And we're going to talk a little bit more after a quick break about what that effect is and how these different conditions are treated with laser. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio. We just heard from some fabulous summer research students from Hawaii Pacific Health, and now we're talking with Leslie Iskovitz, and we're talking about the Erconia laser. This is something that has really come out since I finished training, and talking about some of the new FDA-approved uses for it. When we come back, we're going to talk some more about what this particular laser does with these sorts of treatments, how does it actually beneficially affect people, and where are some areas where maybe it could go in the future. Now, if you or someone you love has ever had a laser treatment or wonders if it might be something that would work for you, you can give us a holler at 941-3689. Toll free from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. We'll be right back after this quick break. Stay with us.
Sandy Sukiyama and girlfriends Rachel Gonzalez, Rhea Davis, and Allison Maldonado just want to have fun. It's a tribute to lady songwriters in the Atherton on August 23rd. They'll be singing Aretha Franklin, Laura Nero, Carly Simon, and more. Saturday, August 23rd at 7:30. Tickets at hprtickets.org or 955-8821 during business hours. Hey, baby, The New York Times calls her one of the jazz world's finest, and HPR is thrilled to welcome back to the Atherton Studio vocalist and pianist Karen Allison for her only Honolulu appearance this year. Join us for a sophisticated evening of bossa nova, ballads, blues, and beyond. Tickets remain for Friday, August 15th at 7:30. Reserve your seats at 955-8821 or purchase online at hprtickets.org.
Aloha, welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Today we're talking about laser treatments. Leslie Iskovitz is here in the studio, and we're talking about the use of, in particular, in this case, the Arconia laser. But what are some of the ways that lasers have become part of medical treatment? And with these sorts of applications, what is it that we're seeing? So, Leslie, I'd like to go through some of the things that you mentioned as far as some of the studies and the beneficial effects. Let's take a look at the one on neck and shoulder pain. That's something that a lot of people experience. And when we talk about using, in my world, we recommend medications, maybe physical therapy, sometimes massage treatments. But what is it that a laser could do for neck and shoulder pain? And how would that actually be beneficial? The trial that they did showed something. What did it show? And is that something that we should look into and should be able to use it for neck and shoulder pain on a regular basis?
Oh, absolutely. Basically, what it showed was that 80% of the people who were treated with the actual laser reported pain relief after a single treatment, and only 15% of the people who were treated with the placebo laser. Because what they did was they created the identical, it was blinded, so they had the identical laser. It looked the same, but it was only an LED. It wasn't a laser, so the patient didn't know, and the practitioner who was applying it didn't know. So they showed that there was an overwhelming difference between the two. And what the laser does is it just I can't tell you exactly how it works, because I don't think science can actually study or can measure exactly how it's operating. But what science can measure are outcomes, and that's why the double-blind clinical studies prove its effectiveness.
Well, and when we talk about that, you mentioned having an identical laser, and I want people to understand what it means when we do these randomized double-blind control trials. And essentially what we're looking at is having people who are participating in the trial look identical in the sense that they try and randomize them into two different groups, someone who's going to get the actual treatment, someone who isn't, and they try and blind it, not just to the person receiving the treatment, but also to the person giving the treatment. Because we don't want to have any kind of a bias. You know, when we're asking people about effects, there's always the question of the placebo effect, or did somebody feel better because they were getting any treatment, not just specifically the, in this case, laser treatment. And so when you have both instruments looking exactly the same, neither the person doing it nor the person receiving it know if they're getting the actual treatment, which really is what makes their description of how it works even more definitive. I mean, it makes it a little less biased. So that's what we're looking at when we're looking at these studies. So you're saying that with one treatment, a lot of people saw some improvement. And with successive treatments, I imagine that the effect was even greater.
Yes. I mean, basically, some conditions will resolve and get great pain relief after one or two treatments. And some are going to take a series of treatments, because you've taken your whole life to get your body to a certain part. And depending on how you've injured it or how you've created it, how you've, what your posture's like, there's any number of different things. But my experience doing the laser myself and others who've used the laser for many years is about 80% of the people who are treated with the laser will receive pain relief.
Well, and that's kind of important because, this is a treatment that does not. One of the things that I'm curious about is that it's never really shown any adverse effects.
Correct. There's never been a negative side effect recorded getting these low-level lasers.
And you really couldn't say that about ibuprofen. I mean, I may prescribe ibuprofen for neck and back pain, but there really are potential side effects. So when you look at a possible side effect versus a treatment that has an 80% chance of success with no side effects, we've really got to take a much closer look at it. Now, we've got a couple of callers. We've got John calling in from Pearl City. John, welcome to The Body Show.
Hello.
Hello, John. Are you there?
Yeah.
Fabulous. I'm Dr. Kozak. What can we do for you today?
Well, I was wondering what type of effect would this Arconia laser have on arthritic joints. My mom has an osteoarthritic knee joint. So would that do her any good? Or
It's an interesting question, you know, because we're looking at some of the FDA-approved uses of laser. Now, Leslie, you've had a lot of experience with laser. You mentioned you had your mom even. Well, that was for a leg infection. Have you ever seen it work with arthritic conditions, and is there an FDA indication for that?
There's currently no FDA indication. There's no clearance for it. And there's two types of arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis. So I've had experience with rheumatoid arthritis where I treated a 93-year-old guy whose hands were frozen to the fingers for like 18 years. He was a concert pianist who could no longer play his instruments. And he lived down the hall from my mom, and I would treat him when I'd visit. And after the third visit, he opened his hands and was able to hold a cane. My brother, the rheumatologist, said, "Now that's a miracle. You show me that's a miracle." Whereas opposed to osteoarthritis, you know, basically people who need a new knee, they're missing the meniscus, they don't have that shock absorber. This laser is not going to regrow that meniscus. Basically what I've seen is the laser can take the inflammation and pain down. It could postpone the knee replacement surgery that's probably inevitable if you don't have a meniscus, but it's not going to replace that. There's just no blood supply to be able to really do that efficiently.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's a good question, John. I appreciate you calling us and asking that because, you know, I've seen some ads for arthritis treatment with lasers. And again, what you brought up, Leslie, is that it will not actually regenerate cartilage, which is really what is missing when you have arthritis, particularly of the knees, for example. But it may actually delay the need to have a replacement. So that's an important difference. And it also helps us to realize that there are certain applications and other things that it may not work as well with.
It's not going to heal everything.
Sure, okay, but a great question from John. So thanks for calling us, John. I appreciate it. We've got another call, Eric from Waimanalo. Eric, welcome to The Body Show.
Hi, welcome.
What can we do for you today?
Yeah, I had a question regarding the uses, the removal or of like fat for obesity or cellulite. I just wanted a comparison about how it would be for versus conventional methods, and I've heard that when you remove like fat cells and you say in turn gain weight, the existing fat cells swell up and you can kind of look disproportionate and that sort of thing. Is that a true statement or?
It's an interesting question. I have a quick clarification, Eric. You said using lasers for fat or obesity versus conventional methods. What exactly do you mean by?
Well, you know, if you're going to get like a liposuction.
Gotcha. Okay. So comparing lasers versus liposuction, is there any difference? And, you know, Leslie, I was looking at this a little bit earlier today because some of the FDA-approved treatments seem to be different than you know, just the standard neck and shoulder pain. One of the curious things they mentioned about fat or cellulite treatment is that it doesn't actually kill fat cells.
Correct.
It just empties them.
Yes.
Whereas liposuction, you're actually physically removing cells from the body. So I think that's, Eric, I think that's a big basic difference, is removing the cells versus emptying the cells. Leslie, the FDA has approved this for several different issues regarding cellulite and fat. What are some of the things that they've seen with lasers?
Well, what they showed what it's actually doing is it's opening up little holes in the little transitory pores in the fat cells, walls of the adipose fat cells. And that's allowing the fat and the contents to empty out. And what they've shown, again, is if you just use the laser, and that's what the beauty of it is, they would only use the laser. They didn't change diet or exercise or add massage.
Now you're making it sound too good. Okay, but all right.
But then it was only like a 72% lost on average 3.5 combined inches off their weight tip size. But if you add additional things, so like when you lose weight, either with liposuction or with this, if you lose inches, it's if you don't change your lifestyle, the fat's going to come back. So it's not a cure-all, but what we say is if you lose a few inches quickly, that's going to give you the confidence and the jump start to change your lifestyle. So that's why, you know, when I started off with a plastic surgeon as my medical director, but I ended up moving it to a naturopath because the naturopath's whole point is good diet, exercise, and so that the combination of the two work exceptionally well.
Well, and I think that's a really good point. And Eric, you know, unfortunately, boy, listen, if there's a magic skinny pill her magic skinny laser. You better believe I would so be a size 2. And I am not. And so, you know, I wish there was an easier answer, but we all have to look at things like diet and lifestyle and exercise and really take a serious look at that, because everybody's always looking for a magic solution, and I'm not certainly saying that you are, Eric, but a lot of times people are looking for something easy. This may help people, but if you don't get down to the basics and work on the diet and work on the exercise and really do some effort on your own, even with liposuction, you know, you can take the fat out and it will come back if you're not following some standard, pretty recommended dietary principles and exercise principles. So it can help you. You know, there's always people who say, I lost a lot of weight and I have this little extra area that doesn't seem to be losing, like, you know, thighs or arms or something along those lines. This can help sculpt,
absolutely,
but it may not necessarily be able to completely alleviate a whole body's worth of too many French fries or something along those lines.
Well, if you keep doing it, you can. I mean, you can lose. I had one woman who kept going for like 3 months. She lost 21 inches combined, waist, hips, and thighs.
But she got motivated and worked on her diet and exercise.
Oh, yeah. She did everything the way she was supposed to do it, and it changed her life.
And that's really the key is, you know, you can't skip certain steps, and that would be some of the steps. But I thank you, Eric, because that is a really different aspect. You know, liposuction, taking the actual fat cells out of the body, laser sculpting, actually just emptying the cells, a little bit different in how you do it. But both of those, I mean, any plastic surgeon you speak to, both of those would suggest that if you're going to make a change cosmetically or physically, to add the diet and the exercise to go with it. So that's a very good point, Eric. I appreciate your calling in. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Leslie Iskovitz, and we are talking about laser therapy and what are the current approved indications for lasers and what are the ways in which we could take a look at this and use it in some practices that currently may not use it right now at all. When we're here, available if you have a question or a concern at 941-3689. Also from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Now, Leslie, we're talking about some of these FDA-approved indications. We talked a little bit about neck and shoulder pain. We just had a caller about liposuction in addition to fat reduction. What are some of the other areas where the FDA has approved the use of lasers?
They have two separate clearances for post-surgical pain, for post-breast augmentation pain and post-liposuction pain. So those, to me, are very significant because wounds are, you know, a surgery causes a wound and requires wound care and leaves a scar.
So does the glass that you picked up as
so,
well.
But,
okay.
But basically, yeah. So what's the difference between a surgical wound, treating a versus any other type of wound? So if you have the ability to prove, which the laser has done, that it will reduce pain and the need for pain medications post-surgically, and it got two specific clearances for two different types of surgeries, why isn't it possible and shouldn't it be used for all post-surgical? Why because if you give a pain med for post-surgical pain, does it depend on what surgery the person had? It's basically you're treating a post-surgical pain. So I look at this saying, because I've treated a lot of post-orthopedic pain, post-foot surgery pain, post-dental surgery pain, and any kind of post-surgery pain, as well as pretty much all wounds that I've treated, has done a phenomenal job of cleaning up the wound, healing it quickly, and virtually making the scar invisible.
Well, that's another thing. You know, we talk about some of the cosmetic sort of procedures. If you're doing breast augmentation or you're doing liposuction, one of the things you want to do is make the scar virtually invisible. So this is another way to allow you to do it. I mean, certainly we know that laser surgery has also been used with skin cancer. It's also been used with Mohs surgery, a particular type of surgery for problems with the skin related to cancer. So it also has other applicable reasons that you could use it, and also minimizing scars. So that's another thing, of course, to consider.
Yeah, I treated two Mohs surgery patients. One was a woman who had two Mohs surgeries, one under each eye, and it was painful, inflamed a month afterwards. And I gave her one treatment, and the pain and inflammation went away. But what's cool about that is her brother, who's a board-certified dermatologist, came in for the second treatment, and I have him on video saying he saw her a week earlier. He expected the pain inflammation to take anywhere from 2 to 6 months to go away. He'd never seen it disappear overnight before.
And so you've actually had some folks that you've worked with pretty amazed at some of the responses that you've seen. We've got a caller on the line. We have Jason from Fort Shafter. Jason, welcome to The Body Show.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. What can we do for you today?
Sure. Sorry, I tuned in late. I'm not sure if you've already covered this, but my question is, what about the application for shin splints or a possibility of a compartment syndrome?
Interesting question. You know, compartment syndrome, you got to be careful with that, because compartment syndrome is when you actually have, there are several compartments of the leg, and if one of those compartments has some type of an injury and an increase in pressure occurs in that area, then you can actually see some changes with lack of blood flow to the muscles in that location, and it's a pretty serious condition. You have to release that pressure pretty quickly, or else you may have some serious damage to that limb, whether it be a leg or an arm, etc. But it's a good point. You know, could you use this type of non-invasive treatment for it? You mentioned shin splints, which are an interesting problem that we see a lot of folks have who do a lot of activity and exercise, whether it be running or other sorts of activities. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't think, Leslie, they've looked at shin splints, but they've looked at another common condition, plantar fasciitis, which is different in its actual physical problem, but similar in the fact that it's inflammation that is occurring. And so I'm wondering, what have they seen with plantar fasciitis? Because that may be an indication that we have to look at shin splints, although it may not be FDA approved for that yet.
Yeah, I mean, basically, because the laser is non-invasive, it could be used on anything and it can't hurt anybody.
And that's an important point. It's not going to cause harm, which is something that often I think we underestimate the value of that statement.
But when it comes to plantar fasciitis, it's a condition that I've treated at least a half a dozen times successfully with people.
Now, describe what that condition is from what you would describe in a layman's term. What is plantar fasciitis? What do people come in and complain about?
They've got chronic heel pain. Basically, it's under, you know, it's the heel or just the side of the heel. And it's something, I had a soldier who was like marching miles and miles a day, and she just had it for 10 years. And I was able to treat it, and it went away. And then it came back like a month later, came back, I treated her again, and went away again. Then she moved away, so I don't know how long it lasted. But
the FDA has actually done some studies with plantar fasciitis, and they've recently given the Erconia laser approval for that.
Correct. That's basically that they created the laser that I normally use is a handheld laser that I have to apply. They've come up with some new lasers now. The one specifically for plantar fasciitis is one where you just put your feet in the device and it's self-administered, basically. You don't need a practitioner or a therapist holding the laser. And what they did was they did two chest sessions two times a week for 3 weeks, and they did follow-ups after 2, 6, and 11 months. And again, over 80% of the pain, you know, went away and stayed away.
Well, and it's an important thing to note. You know, here we are with a non-invasive treatment. Our other treatments for plantar fasciitis include taking anti-inflammatory medications, which in some cases can be helpful, but certainly also doing stretches and other activities. And so, you know, it's kind of hard when you have chronic heel pain to keep walking, which is one of the biggest issues, that you have to keep stretching the heel out and you have to keep stretching that. It's almost like a saran wrap covering of the undersurface of your foot. And in doing so, it helps over time to improve the symptoms, but it's not immediate. It sounds like using something like laser, and they described it as regenerative treatment for heel pain, and that's actually what the FDA cleared it for. So again, we're looking at some proven therapies that have been shown to work for different conditions, and I wonder if one day we'll find a common theme with all of them. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Leslie Iskovitz. We are talking about laser therapy. When we come back, we're going to talk a little more about some of the other indications for it, where it might go in the near future. And we also have a few callers in the line, and we'd like to give them an opportunity to weigh in on the same sort of issue with whether or not lasers could work for them as well. You can join our conversation at 941-3689, toll-free Neighbor Islands 877-941. 3689. We'll be right back after this quick break. Stay with us.
On The Next Humankind.
Meditation has been absorbed into medicine, both clinically and in terms of scientific research, in ways that were literally inconceivable.
A visit with Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, author and researcher into the practice of mindfulness.
Next time on Humankind.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
It's a bold take on three of Shakespeare's greatest plays, King Lear, Taming of the Shrew, Much Ado About Nothing. The Hawaii Shakespeare Festival is presenting them back-to-back with an all-female cast. It's described as a slightly terrifying enterprise, and we'll talk with the production's King Lear tomorrow morning at 8 on The Conversation.
Aloha. Welcome back to The Body Show. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak here in the studio with Leslie Iskovitz, and we're talking about laser therapy and whether or not this has an applicable way to help reduce pain and inflammation. And according to the studies that have been done, the FDA has given it a go-ahead to be used for a variety of different conditions. So far, we've talked about postoperative pain, neck and shoulder pain, plantar fasciitis, different types of cosmetic surgeries, and we're going to talk some more about some of the other differences, because not all lasers are the same. If you want to join us, you can at 941-3689. Toll free neighbor islands 877-941-3689. Now, before we get to our next caller, I want to make a distinction, you know, because Leslie, there's different types of lasers, and some of them have clinical studies. Like we've mentioned, the FDA approved double-blinded randomized controlled studies, and some of them don't. So what is the difference between lasers?
Well, basically, it comes down to the class of laser. So the Econia laser, low-level lasers are anything that's under 500 milliwatts. My particular laser that I work with is more like a 5 milliwatt to 17 milliwatt per diode laser. Whereas opposed to class 4 lasers, which are anywhere from 500 milliwatts to 25 watts, and all of the class 4 lasers, which are infrared, they go from the 810 to 980 nanometers, every one of them is cleared by the FDA as being substantially equivalent to an infrared lamp that was in existence in 1976. Not one of these class 4 lasers has ever submitted a single clinical study to the FDA, and there's been no known clinical studies that I've seen that shows and proves that these class 4 devices actually do something. They do relieve some pain. Infrared heat is a good modality, but they've never proven that it does anything by biostimulating the cells to produce the kind of effects that we have, increased ATP production and increased perfusion and wound healing and the like.
So when we look at clinical studies, when we look at have they proven it? What you're suggesting is that some lasers have definite approval from the Food and Drug Administration based on clinical studies and trials that have been done in a gold standard way as far as medicine is concerned. And that provides some excellent evidence to suggest it works. And then there are some other lasers that seem like they may help, but they don't have the same evidence to suggest an approval from the FDA.
That's correct.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. We have Jeannie from Makiki. Jeannie, welcome to The Body Show.
Thank you. Great show. I was just wondering if Leslie could talk a little bit about using lasers with animals, what kinds of work he's done and what kind of results he's seen.
Working with animals, it's phenomenal. And also, you don't get a placebo effect with animals. So what they did with animals, they worked with Oklahoma State University Veterinary Science. And after this one professor did a case study that he saw this, healing a hind limb wound on a horse is one of the hardest things to do in all of veterinary medicine. So what this guy decided to do was he took 8 horses, created the identical wound on one back leg of each of these horses, treated half of them with a laser, and didn't treat the other half with a laser, was doing constant tests showing how clean the granulization of the wound was. And at day 80, all of the laser-treated wounds were fully healed, fully epithelialized, and none of the non-laser-treated wounds were. So proving that a medical device accelerated the healing of a very difficult-to-heal wound. Locally, we have recently I sold a laser to a vet in Kaneohe, and what I did with hers, she said, I have my own dog is 17 years old, has a decubitus ulcer, not healing for 2 months. I'm not going to do surgery on this poor dog. It's 17 years old. So I said, well, use my laser for a week, see how it goes. The wound mostly healed in that week, and she bought a laser. And now she'll tell anybody that's just phenomenal as far as how it treats wounds and also does it really, really well on arthritis and skin granulomas and the like. So it's really, really good on animals.
Well, and I think that brings up another question, which is, you know, decubitus ulcers are things that don't just occur in animals, and they are a big concern as far as nursing homes are concerned. And so, you know, it looks like there may be some future applications for the use of lasers that maybe we wouldn't have thought of otherwise. And so, you know, looking at the experience of other mammals or other animals, as has really, it may actually show us some ways in which we can apply lasers in the future. A lot of medical studies are done on animals first, and, you know, like it or lump it, that's where we get a lot of the medical information. And this may be a way to take a look at it and then find some other applications. So, Jeannie, great question, great idea. You must have a little inside knowledge about how lasers can help, because you mentioned pets, and that's certainly a way in which it can be applied. Now, I want to go back to the humans. We're going to talk to Beth in IAEA. Beth, welcome to The Body Show.
Hi, thank you. Okay, I'm wondering, what is the exact mechanism that's causing the increase in ATP production? Is that causing, like, an increase in blood flow? I mean, I'm kind of confused about this process.
You know,
You got a good question, Beth, and this is so back to, like, biochemistry for me, and I'm not quite certain. Adenosine triphosphate, which is what ATP stands for, is the energy of a cell, and it's how you get your energy source in your body. I'm not quite sure exactly if there is a way to know the mechanism. Leslie, do you know of anything about how we're certain that it's increasing ATP? It's a great science question, and I sort of feel like if I had a biochemist, we would so be able to answer this for you. But chemistry was so long ago for me. Leslie, you may know some more about this, because it's a very good question, Beth, and you make me want to know and go review some biochem, like, right this minute.
Yeah, I'm not a scientist. I'm a lawyer. Yeah.
Okay, that could be a good or bad statement.
Yeah, take that with whatever you want to take. So I can't speak to the science, but I can read articles. You know, so I have an article in front of me from a Dr. Jeffrey Nelson, who was the medical director for a wound and burn center in Tucson, Arizona for over 10 years before the funding ran out. And he's still chief of plastic surgery for two different hospitals. And he wrote an article, and he's given many talks at burn conferences.
What does he say about ATP, Leslie?
Basically, he says that the premise of low-level laser therapy is it stimulates the cell activation processes, which in turn intensify physiologic activity. That healing is essentially a cellular process, and light energy initiates a cascade of reactions from the cell membrane to the cytoplasm to the nucleus and DNA, and this is called cellular amplification, which won a Nobel Prize in medicine in 1994. And one of these processes that gets enhanced is ATP production in the mitochondria. And when it comes to wound healing, it says all stages of wound healing, hemostasis, inflammation, cell proliferation and migration, collagen synthesis, wound contraction, and wound remodeling proceed more rapidly and more efficiently. So, I can show you, this is a radio.
I can show you pictures. I understand everything that you're saying, and I go, I wonder how you can prove it. And it's a good question, and I'll be honest, I'm not going to be able to answer it for you, Beth. I wish I could. I feel like I wish I had my college biology and biochemistry students here with us. But it's an excellent question, and I think that, we need to look at some of the actual scientific mechanisms. But one of the things that we do know is whether or not we can measure the science on how exactly it works, we can measure the results on people and the efficacy. And so that's certainly a place to start. But excellent science question, Beth, and I'm going to have to tell you, above my head, but it makes me want to look into it. And if I figure it out, we'll let you know.
See, I don't know that science can yet measure exactly how it works, but what science can measure are outcomes of the double-blind clinical studies, and that's what we rely on to prove efficacy.
Well, that's what the FDA was looking at, which is important. Although, again, it brings up that question as far as how much further can you delve into this? And now that lasers are becoming a little bit more applicable in different medical areas, what else could we potentially be able to do to study this? And is there funding to take a look at more of the scientific basis? And I suspect as it gets more mainstream that we may be able to find that. All right, we had a couple of callers who had some questions, which I don't know if we're going to be able to address. One of them was a Dupuytren's contracture. Now, Leslie, that's a contracture in the hand, which is somewhat similar to what you mentioned with the rheumatoid arthritis person, but a fair bit different. And it has to do with very tight calcified or hardened tendons of the hand. And I'm not certain that I know that there's currently no FDA-approved indication to use it for that. I kind of get back to the issue of there's never been any harm.
Right.
although there is no proof about that. The other thing someone called in about was Bell's palsy. Could that potentially be treated? Now, that's kind of a nerve issue, and it's a nerve that stops working correctly, and you see a drooping of part of the face, and it can cause, you know, long-term cosmetic effects. Again, I don't know of any. I'm looking at some of the FDA-approved areas. I don't see that as listed as one of those areas that it could improve. And it's specifically a nerve that's just causing dysfunction. I'm going to say probably not to that one.
Yeah, again, I don't have the personal experience of treating anybody with that condition. It can't hurt that condition. But when it comes to nerves, I can say that I've had, you know, I haven't treated a lot, but I have successfully treated several neuropathy patients.
So there may be some evidence that it could work, but not necessarily scientific, but on personal experience.
Correct.
Okay. We've got my buddy Malachi on the phone from Honolulu. Malachi, welcome to the Body Show.
Thank you. It's good to be back. Yeah, so it seems like this photochemical, photobiological process is the basis of it, but it seems to have such a wide application that I'm curious, is it the same thing in every instance that the cell permeability is reduced?
Well, what the saying is that it's actually healing the cellular structure and healing the restoring the cellular communication between cells. Where there's an injury, cells get injured, they get damaged or die, and they also lose communication with other cells. And what, you know, this is what I'm told. Again, I don't know anything that measures that, but it heals cells and heals cellular communication, and the result is advanced healing.
I got you. Great. Have you had any experience with spinal stenosis?
I have not.
Okay. Or disc protrusion?
I have not.
Okay. Curious. Thank you so much. This sounds fascinating. I think I'm going to ask about my next treatment. I mean, my next appointment.
Arlie Malachi, great question, and certainly it's something that, you know, it looks like there might be some future applications that we may not be fully aware of just yet, because it sounds like it's in the initial phases. We're starting to see more ways in which lasers can be helpful in medicine, and if there's limited, if not no side effects, I think we're going to see this used in a little bit more of a broad application than it is currently. Okay, we've got Carla on the line from Kona. Carla, welcome to the Body Show.
Well, hi there. I just wanted to kind of explain how ATP works.
Bring it on, Carla. I'm on my laptop and I'm looking at it.
Every 2 to 3 seconds, every cell in the body sparks, just like a little generator. And ATP is the fuel of those cells. And if it doesn't have that fuel, it will not spark. The other thing is we want those cells to stay alive as long as possible. And the chemical reaction that takes place is it's called PQQ, pyroloquinine quinone, and that is what causes cells to divide and to stay alive. So the ATP and the PQQ work together, and that's why lasers and electrical stimulation work so well. But if someone wants to really find out more about it, look up NASA, NASA, studies on PQQ and ATP, and you'll see it's the most amazing thing. It's absolutely amazing.
All right, Carla, you've given me some homework to do, looking up NASA and PQQ to discover more on ATP. But it's interesting, you know, I think, Leslie, for a lot of us who study science in college, you know, when we think about the real-world applications of some of these things, it's so long ago since we studied it, it's sort of amazing to have some of these concepts come back, you know, 20, 30 years later and go, wow, there really is a way to apply what I learned so long ago into something that's going on in medicine today. So for all those kids who are out there studying thinking, I'll never use this, listen, you never know, because it could come back in the future and be really helpful. Now, Leslie, I want to take a few minutes to talk about, you know, the FDA has certain approvals that are currently in place for the use of lasers. On a personal note, where do you think this is going to head in the future? I mean, you're seeing that lasers have a broad variety of application, minimal if no side effects. Where do you think it's going to go next? You've been in the field for the last 9 or 10 years. What's up and coming?
Well, as far as where the technology is going, I know currently that they're working on a chronic back pain clearance. They're working on a variety of the problem with wounds. They've tried to do some wound stuff. They in France with one of the leading wound specialists, Luc Théat, who's like written the textbooks on wounds. It's just too hard to get the population and the type of wounds and the numbers to do it efficiently. And so they have to identify which studies they're going to do that they can follow through and make it all work. But they're very good at finding, you know, working with the FDA, and because they design the study and the FDA approves the study before they do it, you know, they along with the IRB. But as far as where the technology is going, that really depends on doctors. The biggest issue that I've had trying to introduce this technology is that I've gone to 100 surgeons locally in Hawaii and said, we have two post-surgical clearances, reduces pain, reduces the need for pain meds. I will let you use my laser on your patients, and you'll see for yourself. I'll teach you how to use it. Or if your patients, if you don't have the time, I'll come in and I'll treat your patients with the laser post-surgically for free. And not one of the surgeons who I've asked, which is every cosmetic surgeon in this town, has taken me up on that offer. So where this
you're
laser...
You're in trouble now, because if anybody's listening, you might be getting some calls.
Any doctor who's willing to refer patients, I will, you know, I mean, that's what I want, is I can prove this laser works. But I can't prove it to a doctor if the doctor himself won't read the studies, if they won't use the laser for free on their patients.
Well, and I think there's, you know, part of what we're discovering is that medicine has changed a lot since we were in school. And so there's a lot of new updates and different technologies that are now available that may not have been mainstream when we studied. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about arthritis and the fact that it can't really delay the inevitable. If you need a knee replacement, you're going to eventually need a knee replacement. And so therefore, it may not have a role in doing anything other than delaying pain. And so in that case, you know, the traditional method of if you have bad arthritis, you might need to go ahead and do a replacement kind of still fits into the algorithm. But I think, you know, there's a lot of room for the additional use of non-harmful treatments, in particular that are FDA approved for that indication. And that's really where I think we ought to focus our efforts, is taking a look and saying, okay, the FDA say it's good for this. How can we use that so that we can build on that already evidence-based use of that particular device and help it become even used even more often? So, you know, that's certainly an area where we can have some gains, I'm hoping. Now, as far as anyone who might want to take you up on that, you do have an email, Leslie. What's that?
LESISKO@AOL.com.
And if anybody out there wants to hear more about it, you can always email the station at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And Leslie, I'll forward those messages to you so that you can respond to them accordingly and take a look at some of those options that you might have presented. Now, as far as future for lasers, the one that you've been talking about in particular is the Erconia laser. Are there other brands that are currently available?
Well, there's a whole lot of lasers. There's probably 100 manufacturers, but Erconia is the one that's at 635 nanometers, 5 to 7 milliwatts of power, fully programmable as far as frequency goes.
So, is that the one they've done the FDA studies with?
And that's
with?
The only one they've done these FDA studies with.
And that's kind of an important thing.
They spend millions of dollars a year on research. I don't know of any of the other companies that spend any money on research.
Well, and part of the issue in medicine is trying to have those double-blind, placebo-controlled trials that show proof and efficacy, and that's one of the ways in which medicine works. Well, I want to thank you so much. The hour has gone by so quickly, Leslie.
Yeah, it's unbelievable quick, but yeah, I just want to give hope to people in pain, you know, especially wounds. I mean, wounds is a $50 billion a year industry, and this laser has the ability to help wounds.
Well, and that's an important thing that we need to take a look at. And certainly I hope we do so more in the future. If you'd like to hear this show again, you can click on hawaiipublicradio.org, follow the links to the Body Show, and you can hear our podcast. Our engineer is David Chong, our executive producer, Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. We'll see you next week. We're going to be talking about COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And how do you know if you're at risk for that? It's a disease of the lungs and something important for all of us to know about. We'll see you next week, Monday at 5, on The Body Show. We'll see you. Woo!